Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
And welcome back to the Beer Ladies podcast. I'm Lisa and I am your host this week. And I'm joined by only one co-host today. I have Christina. Hello, Christina.
Hello.
And this week we have a special guest. We have Mo Deasy. Do you want to say hello?
Hello, everyone.
And there's a hello from him. Yeah, we have a man on today, people. We are allowed from time to time. Because we are going to be chatting about heritage grains today and heritage malting and what that means. But before we dive into that, we do want to, do our usual sort of shout out to everyone for continuing to like us and share us and subscribe. Thank you very much. We are at Beer Ladies Pod on most of the socials. We are on YouTube as well. And we do have a link tree now where you can find links to all of our various things, whether that's all of our different handles, all of our previous episodes. You can buy merch. You can buy us a coffee. And we love it when you guys do that. So thank you so much. So before we dive in, we'll do a quick, what are you drinking or what do you have? So Christina, start with you.
So firstly, thank you so much to McHughes for sending this to me and to all of us, actually, all of the podcast hosts this season. They sent us a lovely package of their newest beer in the Explorer series. This is number 5. It was made with Larkins. So this is the Road Trip Explorer series. So this one is supposed to have grapefruit, passion fruit, and guava. It sounds really amazing and I can't wait to try it. So very excited. So thank you so much for sending this to us.
Wonderful. Thank you very much. And before I go on to mine, Mr. Deasy, what have you got there?
Well, I have one of my own actually. This is a can of Ramoke. Well, you can't really see it. Anyway, this is one of my first single source beers, whatever.
Oh, lovely.
And it's a smoked sour, which is possibly kind of unique.
A
little bit of rhubarb in there as well. So,
very, very unique indeed. So we definitely want to hear more about the whole sort of single source path and what that looks like. But before we dive in, I couldn't find anything locally, at least in my immediate area, that was either specifically using heritage grains or a canvas beer. I know we will get some more stock eventually, but I don't have a lot locally yet. So I went for my closest brewery. So I have a Hope Pass If You Can. So I figure that has the fewest air miles and everything else on it. And I know that they are doing some cool green initiatives as well. So always enjoy Hope's Pass If You Can. Always enjoy a good pale ale.
And they brewed a beer with Emer, actually, I think.
They did.
Type of heritage grain, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Last year they did that with their winter one was with the Emer. And they we did sort of say, ooh, it would be really cool to follow up with them to see, one, if they're going to do any more of that, but also, two, if they're going to sort of do more with the archaeology project that they've been doing a little bit there on as well. Because we are very interested in both current heritage grains, and I know Christina and I are both interested in super deep heritage grains and what that might look like. So
I met the farmer actually recently, and I was like, oh well, if they want to mold some of it, I could mold some of the grain and then they could use it as malt in the beer.
Shout out to Hope if
you're listening.
Richie, then tune in. So great idea. Wonderful. So I think we'll probably need some definitions for people. So I think For us who are sort of nerdy about this, we sort of toss a lot of these things around, but and we do have a Malt 101 episode, but if we want to just sort of set a baseline for everyone, what do we mean when we say malting, and what do we mean when we say heritage grains? And we'll probably kind of dive into what do we mean by the grains versus the malt. And there's a lot there to unpack for someone who might not be as technically inclined. So definitions.
We got an error, right? We can okay, so very simply, okay, grain, that's what you grow in the field, right? Malting is the process of converting. You wake up the grain by soaking it, and you start it to germinate. And after 5 to 7 days, you stop that process. And what you're doing is you're trying to create enzymes to convert the starch that's held in the grain into sugars. And that's, those enzymes are what we use in the mash tun to convert all of the starch into sugar, because yeast feed all sugar, not all starch. And so that's the big difference between grain is all starch, malt, we got the enzymes, we got the starch into sugars, and that's what we need to make beer, basically. Very important step. And then when we talk about heritage, so pretty much everyone is growing modern varieties, which are quite short straw, which originate from Norman Borlaug after World War II, and he invented these dwarf genes. He found these dwarf genes in varieties, which combined with nitrogen fertilizers meant we could increase yields. And that's the start of the Green Revolution. So to me, heritage grain is a very wide term. But I kind of draw one line, which is once you start going to shorter varieties, that's kind of the start of intensification. And ancient grains is probably a different category. So like heritage grains, you're probably talking 1940 and earlier, 1910s, you know, into the 18th century, stuff like that. But they're heritage grains. Ancient grains, you're talking Emmer, Einkorn, you're going back 10,000 years. Like that's way fado, like that's why they call them ancient grains. You know, they're really not optimized at all. But yeah, it's slightly an ambiguous term, because sometimes you can buy a heritage sourdough in a supermarket with a mite of 20% spelt, and that spelt they call it a heritage grain, but actually it's a modern variety of this heritage wheat. So it can be adulterated an awful lot, basically.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think people may have some more familiarity if they're into gardening or that kind of thing, because there are so many varieties, or we'll say again, sort of big catch-all sort of heritage varieties of things like tomatoes, or even I would say especially apple trees. That's been a whole interesting thing, or even apple varieties, even less than trees, since they have all the grafting and it gets really confusing. But
heritage vegetables are great. Particularly if you're growing them in your back garden, you're not worried about yield. You want flavor and stuff like that. And it's like, my mum, we set up a polytunnel, and first year she grew these tomatoes, and it was like, the variety was called Moneymaker, and they tasted terribly.
Right.
And it was like, why did I go to all this effort to make tomatoes that taste terrible? And I was like, you know, go to a heritage variety, you get less yield, but more flavor. And it's like, that's why you grow a tomato, is to make a really tasty tomato that you kind of go, yeah, I can't buy that in the shop. It's great. It's awesome. And so in a way that ties into why we're growing heritage grains on the farm to malt, to brew them into beer, is because if we're going to all this hassle, we might as well use the best possible grain that we can get, you know? And that's historically in the brewing world, people talk about pale ales, so your pale ale malts, your lager malts, you know, generally those are base malts which take up, say, 80% of your grain bill, typically. But if you want to make a really good beer, most brewers are like, oh, get Maris Otter. It's got more flavor. It's a heritage variety. It's been floor malted. It's got more flavor. So that kind of started me on, and it's more expensive, basically. And that started me on the journey, basically, of like heritage grains. And like my dad can remember growing Maris Otter, basically. It's not that old, basically.
Yeah.
So I was like, cool, let's get some Maris Otter. And they were like, no, you can't get it in Ireland. You need to be within East Anglia or wherever they grow it, basically, and have a contract and blah, blah, blah. And like that, to me, that's the reason why I brew beer, is to not be part of a mass market conglomerate. Basically, because when we grow malting barley commercially, we grow it for the largest malting company in the world, who sells it to the fourth largest brewery in the world. You know, whereas I'm like, I'm trying to decommoditize and get away from that commodity treadmill, basically. You know, because when we sell grain as farmers, we sell it on the world market price. That's right. We're paid based off what grain is traded in Paris. You know, that's all around the globe. That's what grain all links into. And so, and it's basically the price of grain in 1950s is the same as it is right now. Okay, 2 years ago.
Oh gosh.
Now, it was £150 back in 1950, which 3 tons would buy you a car, you know, whereas I'm like, 3 times 150 basically wouldn't buy you much of a car in today, you know. But that's kind of why when we're going to do the malting, I was like, ooh, heritage, can we get more flavor? And yes, we're going to sacrifice yield, but when I'm malting it myself and brewing it myself, I'll take the sacrifice if I can get higher yield. And then there's also this stuff about disease resistance and stuff like that. And so one of the negatives in terms of grain, and I'm apologizing, I'm going pretty heavy into
agriculture. No, this is great. We love it.
One of the negatives for the farmer is that these are tall straw varieties. So basically some of them like go up to my shoulder. I have a Galway land wheat, and like I used to grow it as a spring variety, and because there's very little reference to Galway land wheat anywhere on Google, basically. And so if you find any references or anyone comes up with any references, please let me know, because I know nothing about this. But now that I know it's a winter variety, but basically I grew it by accident as a winter variety. Because I'd grown it as a spring, some seeds had fallen on the ground, germinated, and I was harvesting the next year. And I was like, what's that standing like 2 foot above everything else? So I got out of the combine. It's like, here it was up at my shoulder, basically. I was like, okay, it's a winter variety and it's quite happy. But like literally, you know, the modern variety is at my waist, this winter one's at my shoulder. That's the difference in height. But the difference in height in the straw is also mirrored under the ground. So you got a much bigger root system.
Okay.
So when we're not if we're trying to reduce inputs and not use as much fertilizers, we need a big root system to go out into the soil and get the nutrients. So that's, now you have that negative of less yield, but if you're using less inputs and you've got better plant health because the root system is connected with the plant's health. And basically all grain was organic before we started figuring out what fertilizer was and stuff like that. That's my thought of now. Basically, I'm going back to seed banks, or I have been for years going back to seed banks, getting these heritage varieties, growing them out and trying to see how they work in a modern field. And then basically I grow them all the way until, as long as they're not terrible and like really run over or something, like, and I'm just like, no, I can't, I'm not keeping that again. But so I kind of grow them for a few years, because you start with like 20 seeds, right?
Yeah.
Because that's what you get from a seed bank. And it's like the famous one is in Norway, it's like deep mountain, and they've got seeds, every variety of everything, like it's mad. But you can get, you have to write a pretty convincing email basically and convince them that you are the next grain breeder and going to do amazing things. And you can get these 20 seeds and grow them. So typically it takes me about 5 years between getting the 20 seeds. And my dad would look at them and he's like, hey, one of those is cracked. You're down to 19. I'm like, yeah, I know. and if they germinate, we might be down to 17 or 16. Right. But that gives you 16 plants or 15 plants, which give you enough seeds, and you grow them year on year. And then you have to figure out if they grow well in the modern world. And then because we brew on a very small scale and we malt on a very small scale, we can test these out and kind of see how do they work and what sort of flavors they generate, basically. And then if that works, grow them again and grow them again. Yeah. And this is all about keeping seed as well. Because basically this isn't owned by a large company. It's heritage. It's my ancestors, basically. It's the previous people who owned this variety. And that means that basically we keep the seed, we keep a portion of the seed, we clean it and we plant it from year to year. And what my little sort of trend towards is to try and get these grains, because you're keeping the seed, you're going to start adapting these seeds to North Tipperary and how we farm. So basically in 10 years' time, these will end up being slightly different to where they were previously. which is really cool and exciting, and adapting for climate change, all these really important things. Diseases are way more prevalent, much more problems with them as farmers. So if we can adapt and use these kind of older heritage genetics that have these interesting flavors, and if you can't guess, I love it.
we said a little bit about this, and it's been, you know, almost 2 years now on our Malt 101 episode, how, you know, people tend to really overlook how important malt is in really imparting the flavor. And a lot of it, you know, and again, I think some of this is because at your huge commercial level, you know, you've already done so much to it to sort of, you know, kind of give the malt a flavor of its own before you even get to the brewing process, either, you know, because you've made it a certain kind of malt or, you know, different things like that. But I guess when you strip it back to just kind of, this is what it is, and before you start to tinker with it in other ways, how do you find that at that sort of almost micro level, or how do you experiment once you're in there kind of, you know, malting away?
So the brewer has the largest effect on the flavor of the beer, you know, and that's down to yeast, and it's down to hops. Like hops, if you dry hop something heavily, you're like, what's going to drive the flavor, you know, or if you use a Belgian yeast or something, that's going to drive the flavor.
Sure.
But if you kind of strip those down and kind of use more neutral or not aggressively flavored, then malt becomes this thing. And it's a large ingredient, basically.
Yeah.
And that's what they say kind of in it's coming across the American craft brewing scene. They're like, malt is the soul of beer, basically. And that's like, that's when they're like, you want to make a real special beer, they're like, use Maris on it. Get that 80% base being something cool. And to me, it's like the difference between using 80%. So actually, at the moment, we use all base malt is our own heritage malt, malted on the farm. So we still buy in specialist malt. Sure. That can be a small percentage. And I don't have a roaster. I would love to get a coffee roaster and play around. Shout out to any coffee roaster. If you want to take some of our malt and roast it, that would be awesome. So to me, that the malt is kind of the soul of the beer. And that's, if you can get 80% of that being like a really flavorsome malt, then that's something interesting. Rather than kind of spicing it with a few, like, you know, some Vienna or some of these roasted malts, can you put 80% being something which has a bit more flavor and a bit more nuance, you know, and then you're building a beer kind of from the ground up. But also you have to think when I'm all about the soil as well, the root system. Yeah. That's where it starts with the soil, the root system. You go into the grains and the variety and get diversity into the field, basically. So a lot of what I'm trying to push towards now is not just a single variety, these land races. And what we used to grow was, it wasn't just a single species, but it wasn't just a single variety. There was lots of variety within that and variation, basically. So that's what I'm trying to actually re-emulate, is get multiple heritage varieties and mix them together. So now I actually have, what I was just looking before this podcast was, I was checking on, I've planted a population rye, population wheat, and another landrace wheat, a Galway land wheat. And so that's the first time that I'll be like, might nearly have a ton of some of these. So this will be like large quantities for me, basically. Some breweries probably use that in half a brew, but anyway. So a population now is not just a single variety. This is multiple varieties in the same field, and they all have their strengths and weaknesses. So like, our weather is getting more and more variable. We've got droughts, we've got wet periods, we've got all of this. So if you've got multiple varieties, some might survive well in a drought. Some might survive well in a wet period. So at least you get this resilience, that you get a consistent yield each year. It's not a sprinter. Like, it's not going to be the best yield, but if you have a consistent yield, and if I'm basing our brewery around malting our own grain, I want to be able to malt that every year. I don't want to be like, 2025, sorry lads, I'm just shut down for a year, I have no grain. You know, that wouldn't be cool. So it's kind of like building that resilience in terms of climate by having that genetic diversity in the field. But now bring that through to the malting, complete different set of skills for malting. Like, you give that to a commercial big malt house, they'll be like, what are you trying to get me to do? Like, serious? Like, no. How long do you germinate for? Like, don't know. Like, it's, there's a mixture. So like, you know, judge it yourself there. So that's, there's a bit of craft in that craft malting, basically, as well. But then put that into the brewery. So now we can tweak how we mash and all that's going on. And particularly when we're doing mixed fermentation, and barrel aging. A lot of our beers are barrels, because if I have a choice between stainless and barrels, I'm like barrels every time. Takes way longer, don't have the same control, but you got right. awesome things that happen in a barrel. But in a barrel as well, you got mixed fermentations, you got yeast, you got bacteria, you got bread, you got all sorts of things going on. So my thought is, by having lots of populations and variety in the field, put that into the brewery, feed that to multiple yeast strains and bacterial strains. Now you can get lots of nuance and lots of flavor being developed. So that's, in a way, I'm like, yeah, if you feed these beers to like a single Saccharomyces, real clean, a smash, you know, single hop, single yeah. thing. Yeah, it'd be interesting to compare it to Maris Otter and to something else. But really, I think it's when you put it into a barrel, into mixed fermentation, that's where you kind of get that step on, basically. And yeah, that to me is like, that's my dream, basically, is making those sorts of beers.
That's making the really interesting vertical tastings, where you're going to get really huge variation from, you know, year on year with the same base initially. But
So and like it's going to be terrible as a side by side comparison in terms of scientific, like, and I accept that. It's just like, yeah, like it's just different, you know. I did do a smash once with a biodynamic beer. And I have a fully biodynamic beer in a barrel actually as well.
Just like fully biodynamic, like there's some bones buried in the field too and the whole thing.
I'm not the biodynamic farmer. Right. The farmer who gave me the malt, and he was like, could you make beer? Or like, yeah, do you want to malt this and make beer? Yeah. And I was like, yeah, I'm good with that. Let's play with that. And then we have our own, so we grow our own hops as well. And then I spontaneously fermented that as well. Because in biodynamic, you can't be like, it's sort of an ethos as well, and there's a philosophy behind it. Mm-hmm. And it's like, you can't really be taking a packet of yeast and just like,
right. You know,
that's not that cool. So I was like, right, okay, full biodynamic, let's go spontaneous and chuck it in a barrel and see where it goes. So let's check up and see how it's getting on, actually. That's one of my to-do lists to do.
Absolutely. Christina, kind of in some ways similar to what we were talking about the other week, some of your medieval-ish brewing. Yeah.
Yeah, actually, I was going to ask you, like, what is the sort of inspiration for your beer recipes? Do you take the beer recipes from historical heritage recipes as well? Or do you sort of think about the flavors of the malt and kind of go from there? Do you build it around the malt or the hops? Or how do you come up with your recipes?
Well, we do lots of beers, so there's lots of different ways to come up with recipes. I did a McGee Marshall Stout that was a historian over in the UK. And he basically via Twitter was like, hey, I've got some cool recipes you're doing. That was Sprat Archer and Irish Gold Tour. And he's like, oh, I've got recipes based with these grains. Do you want to brew a beer with them? I was like, I do. You know, because that was different mashing techniques. So that was kind of fun to do. It was a step mash, and it was like, I'll do that. Do you know, because in a malt like that, if you're not that super consistent, all the same grain, it's like, ooh, you might have slight different starches and stuff. So a longer step mash, I was like, yeah, that makes sense to me. That, you know, back in the day, picture back to what farming was when this was made at the turn of the century. I was like, yeah, okay, let's use a historic mashing technique. Because even like in the brewing, like when we were home brewing, it was like, I do love a Belgian quadruple, basically. And it was like, oh, let's do a decoction mash. And most people now are like, well, malt is so perfect, you don't need to do a decoction mash. You know, you can make it up in a different way, basically. And it's like, yeah, but what if you've got a heritage malt that has all these different starches that isn't completely perfectly modified? Sorry, modification is how much enzyme and how much conversion of that starch is there. And then I'm like, ooh, historical technique might be useful using historical malt. Do you know what I mean? Because you have what used to be grown back there. So yeah, I am very interested with historical recipes. And using that inspiration, like as I read Jean Leclerc's book, and he would be, he's the first textbook in brewing, basically. Because it's real old world like stuff, and it's like, but we're brewing old world like, you know, wood fired boil kettle, like, as in it's all pretty rudimentary, that it's like, that's not that different to like way back in history, basically. So in a way, that's where I do take a lot of inspiration from those techniques and stuff, and then add a little bit of modern.
Oh yeah,
I'm not turning my back on all science, basically, but like using some of that older stuff. Like, there's a cool story. We were at a local historical society meeting, and close to us is Lara, and there's an Abbey of Lara, and he did a dig and he found these malt kilns. Like that, I was like fascinated. I was like, oh, that's really cool. Like from the 10th century, 12th century, like way back, basically. And he showed the diagrams of how it was and how, you know, they had a fire and a little thing to keep away the sparks. And it was on a hazel sort of basket, and that's where you laid the malt out and all of this. And it's like, that's kind of like, yeah, that's kind of how I use my malt kiln. It's like, I've got a fan now and I've got a heat exchanger, but like otherwise, ooh, actually, but remote, this is the smoked malt. This smoked. This is one of my first batches of malt. And basically, I got a leak from the chimney and I got some of the smoke coming into the malt. And basically, I was like, oh, this is like smoked malt. I was like, ah, boo. And then I was like, oh, wait a second. Why don't I just make a beer? Mm-hmm. Like, it's a smoked beer. What the heck? You know, I might as well do something with it. And that was kind of on the, do you know Francis Malman, actually? He's a chef and he cooks with fire. He's on like chef's table or something. And he does like mad stuff. He's very like very entertaining. It's like 5-star hotel has a big fire and like in the middle of their lawn wrecks the place. They have to probably lay new grass and like cover it over. But he was like, he trained as a Michelin star chef in Paris and he went back to Argentina and he was trying to emulate the same stuff in Argentina. And then he was like, why am I trying to do Parisian food in Argentina? I should cook with fire. I should cook with what's around. So very much the inspiration is to try and use like what's around and what's Irish or what's that history. And that's trying to use like sweet gale and these ancient brewing herbs and use what's, so like I brew IBAs, yeah, and we buy in hops for that. But I'm more interested in trying to, can we create something that's more of this area and of this historical background, do you know? Because then it's suited, like the hops we grow are not juicy mango, all of this stuff, like, you know, and it's time consuming to harvest them. Like, I'm not putting a shed load into a beer. I don't make IPAs with my own hops, like, basically, you know, because it's so much work. It's like, if you have an IPA, I'll buy some, someone else has picked them and harvest them, and let's get the mango and all of this into it. But it's, oh, and actually, I do a beer with pine tips. Because actually it's a little play on a pale ale, basically, you know, because you've got the hops which are resinous and piney and all these flavor, and I'm like, yeah, here's actual pine, lads.
Yeah, we were actually just talking about that over the weekend, funnily enough, because they all around the Philadelphia area, that was a historical approach because that was what they had around. So your 17th, 18th century recipes all have spruce tips and other things like that. And although I will say I've tried a couple of them and some of them can be a bit much, but again, I think some of that is modern yields, like you were talking about before, just very different from what you might've had historically. And maybe the amounts they put in gave you a very different character in a beer that might've had maybe a smokier character already from the malt. Just again, thinking of those historical techniques.
Yeah.
They were probably smokier for whether they wanted that or not. So, you know.
And that's like, that's the scary bit is like when I first brewed with sweet gale is this herb, basically. I was like, I have no context as to how much is too much or how much, you know, because if you have a hops, it's like, oh, pale ale, this is how many grams of hops. Sure. You know, and even with our own hops, it's like, you know, where's the alpha acid? Is this 6.6 or is this like, and okay, some of them we have the variety so we can have a guess as to where they are. But there's some hops that we're growing on the farm basically all the time. Which are wild landrace, whatever you want to call them, heritage if you want, really. But I don't know what variety they are. I don't know what alpha acid they are. So it's like, how do you brew with them? You're like, yeah, okay, that smells strong. You know, that's good hop. Yeah, we'll go with 100 grams. Let's see how that goes. You know, so that's like one of our first spontaneous. We put a bit too much hops in it because we're using our own hops. And I was like, you know, trying to hit 10 IBUs or less, and like, yeah, probably was 15 or 20. I was like, all right, okay, cut that right down. Let's see where we go the next time. And that's it. Like, what I say about our brewing is like, it's the art of brewing. Like, it's not the measurement heavy, like, here's everything, you know, because it's like, right, here's the grain, here's the malt, you taste it, you're using your senses as to what it is and what it's tasting, and then trying to picture forward through the process how that'll turn out in the beer. So that's, yeah, there's a lot of imagination, and I suppose that's why we're Canvas Brewery, the artist in painting. Like, it's, you know, I can talk for hours and never mention the name of our brewery, basically. Like, what's the name of your brewery? You're like, oh, you're standing in it. Yeah, Canvas, that's who we are. Yeah.
And I think it's interesting too, just thinking kind of a little bit what you were saying before, how, you know, you're thinking about sort of a historical-ish, what we'll say, approach, because I presume, like, you know, kind of like farming in the past, you'd have had bits and pieces of time where there's a lot of downtime. You're waiting for things to happen. And I guess, like, when you're just starting your brew kettle, or, you know, just starting like the fire, that you're kind of waiting. So I went, yeah, Mad Max, I'd love to hear a little bit more about Mad Max. And what do you find in terms of, you know, how much, again, I don't know if waiting or sort of downtime is the right word, but it's definitely like a more labor intensive, let's say, than sort of flipping a few switches like a modern brewery. Yeah.
So, okay. So Mad Max are a wood fire boiled kettle, and it's because it's a bit dystopian, like, as in I welded it myself, and I was like, kind of had this crazy idea, and it kind of came out of, like, we're down north of Bray, we're on the farm. I was like, well, we're not in an industrial state, so we don't have three-phase electricity. It's like, do we get oil? Do we get gas? And I work with stoves, and basically I was like, hey guys, why don't we, like, go wood fired? And they're like, yeah, sounds a good idea. And I was like, well, no, it's probably not a good idea, but, like, I think it could work. And, like, it would save us spending a load of electricity or, like, oil or gas, because it's like, sustainability is big in what we're doing, right? So we by having a wood fired kettle, and it's all wood from our own woodlands and ditches. So it's like, we can harvest and manage the woodlands. And that's, we try and use couples with standards, basically, because it's a more sustainable method, basically. Clearfell Sigma Spruce is not a positive thing. So when everyone talks about afforestation, it's like, yeah, that's really positive. Getting a non-native species and planting it in a really terrible technique is terrible for the soil. And no. Anyway, so we use couples with standards. And again, genetic diversity, it allows native trees, all the native varieties will coppice. So coppicing is where you cut the tree, right? But it regrows from the roots and puts out shoots the next year. And so you don't kill the tree, the root system's still there, you don't get erosion, you don't get any of that. So you can go in, harvest a little area, and you still get the trees growing. And by having the older trees, they will start to produce seed. So that's genetic reproduction. Ah, so we can get adaptation out of our woodlands. So again, our woodlands will be different to other woodlands that are commercially planted using the same genetic material. Common thread, genetic diversity, interest, all these other different things.
Yeah.
And so that's sustainability. So that's sourcing our own energy. And then we've an Archimedes screw and solar panels to get our own electricity and our own water. I don't know what the question was. Where was I going with this?
Just thinking about, you know, Mad Max and how, just the amount of time you really spend, both just in starting things up, you know, starting a literal fire versus, you know, sort of a more, let's say, modern in air quotes setup, because modern is not necessarily good. It all depends.
But, so, like, but we start the process by harvesting the wood. So, like, that's a long time, and then get it to dry. And then, but no, even on a brew day, right? So we heat all our water in Mad Max. So rather than just turning on the HLT and on a timer and be like, cool, we start the day, we got hot water to start with. I'm like, light the fire in Mad Max, heat the water. So that does give me an hour and a half to 2 hours where I'm waiting to get on to the next stage. So that's actually where a lot of my creative time starts, because it's like, cool, this is what I'm brewing. Yeah, great. And then I'm sitting there and kind of, I'm doing lots of other stuff. And I'm like, I wonder if I did this and then that, how would that affect the beer? And then basically 2 hours later, I'm like, there's a slightly different beer being created, but that's the, very much each beer has its own idea and its own identity as to, I'm generally trying to achieve something or exploring some idea or some, like, how would this malt interact with this or do something of interest? And then basically, particularly once you put it into a barrel or add, like, so now we don't really buy in any yeast. I try and get some farmhouse. So one of my next beers is with a Lithuanian farmhouse yeast. Ooh. So again, and Kvaik's at class, basically. That's another whole thing on yeast, basically. We're trying to talk about malt. But I'm trying to not buy in yeast, because if we're growing our own grain, we're getting our own hops, our own water and herbs, it's like, you don't be just putting in USO5 standard ale yeast in there, basically. It's like, well, what else is out there? And what's in this farmhouse culture of handing it down, because like Kavaig's is a cool, fascinating culture, and it's like it survived in really remote areas, and it is a window into the past and what used to happen. And but this is all stuff that's handed down, you know, from generation to generation, and then if it goes wrong, you go to your cousin or you go to somewhere else and you get the yeast back, and that's it survives and goes down that trend. So I'm like, in a way, that's a little snippet into what used to happen in Ireland. It's just industrialization has wiped out a lot of this here, and that's whereas those hop plants that were growing in our farm, to me, that is a sign, and that is in archaeology terms, you can use plants as a form of archaeology, what's growing in the area as a sign of what was going on in the past.
Absolutely.
It's like that hop, like it's a pretty plant, but like I couldn't tell it from a briar. It was just growing there. And it's like, to me, that is a sign there was some brewing going on. But pre-industrialization, pre-brewing going into the cities and into industrial areas, brewing was going on in the house. So there probably was a farmhouse culture of brewing going on. So it's like, how do I connect into that? And it's like, if you look into extreme places, you can see it in Norway, you can read about it. And like, I was in West Africa and like they were brewing, and I was like, this is mad. Like, this is just brewing in a household level, like, and it complete subsistence. But like, oh, and what's very funny is like, and it's sour beer. It's like, I was like, this is in Benin, it's like, this is the cheap, you know, this is the local boisson, so just drink in French. And it's like, I was like, yeah, but like, this is sour beer in America, is like the most expensive stuff. And you're like, you know, they're looking for this culture. Yeah. Like, oh, I got a weird strain of bacteria that can create an awesome sour beer. And it's like, you know, to me, that's the really mad thing. Like, in one sense, it's subsistence, but in another sense, it's now become trendy and kind of cool because you got variations. And actually, lactobacillus does cool stuff onto, like, you can ferment food, you can do it into beer. It does cool stuff, basically.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's funny because we've touched on that on a couple other recent and not so recent podcasts. Like we just had Ulrika from Schnee Oil on talking about, you know, the Brett in, well, how the Brett and the lacto kind of went together and still go together in her Berliner Weisses, and how that's different from what you see in a lot of the commercial Berliner Weisses, which I'm air quoting now. Yeah. But when we had Jesse from Kweza on in Rwanda, again, the sour beer that they make there, a lot of that is, it's sour, but it's fresh. You know, it's meant to be like that. You're meant to consume it right away. And that's so different from some of the other sort of, again, like you say, kind of the trendier sour beers. A lot of those are, you know, fermenting away for a while, and then they get sort of, you know, packaged and shipped out. And it's just, it's funny how you're arriving at kind of a similar result, but with very different kind of audiences, very different techniques, and different price points. So
and some of that stuff, like beer was meant to be drunk fresh, and that's one of the things I think is quite different to now. And actually, when we're talking about historical beers, like they brewed it and drank with it quickly, whereas, you know, if you're trying to do historical beer and then you barrel age it for 12 months, it's like yeah, they didn't do that. So like, that's, now I do love aging beers though. Like I think it does help the quality, and like oak barrels are amazing things basically. But yeah, how, that's one of the big questions on like, how do you do historical beer and drink it fresh compared to, you know,
Yeah, exactly. And I know, and like Christina, you know, I've talked about this too, that, you know, there's probably this little portion that you set aside to age for special occasions or for, you know, X or Y, but the majority of it is, like you say, you know, sort of farmhouse level subsistence, or maybe not even necessarily farmhouse, but it could be, you know, townhouse level, where you're brewing for yourself, maybe some of your neighbors, and it's very different. It's a different vibe, man. So
yeah, because definitely some of the braggots I've seen, they would age for not like an anywhere near like a year or anything like that, but longer than. But a lot, most of the beer in Ireland from the history that I can see is really fresh. And there's the same thing in the UK. But yeah, there's always exceptions. There's always exceptions.
I suppose the honey, like honey is of huge value as well, historically. So like, if you're adding honey to a beer, it is kind of special as well. So giving it a bit of time to, I do want to play with more honey in the brewery as well, actually. That's something to.
Yeah, and actually that's a question I had too, is, you know, like you say, you've got your own, you know, you've got your own malt, you've got your own hops, obviously your own water, and trying to sort of cultivate over time your own yeast. It was sort of, are there other ingredients you'd love to have locally produced? And again, honey is one of those that's so hard to do at scale unless you are full-time kind of, you know, looking after the bees. But
and that's, there's a whole skill in honeybees and how you manage and like all of that. which is something I'd like to do at some stage, but that's another little rabbit hole to get down. But like, that's actually one of the things we do, sorry, in terms of fields, like grains and malt, we do a lot of cover crops now. So between, so malting barley is normally sown, is spring malting barley. So you sow it in the springtime, you harvest it in August. So there is a time between then and the next spring where historically the ground would just lay fallow doing nothing. And whereas basically now what we're doing is towards conservation agriculture, more crop rotation and more cover crops so that the soil is always covered. And so right now we've got like 12 species of different plants, basically as diverse as possible out there. And they're all, most of them all flower. So basically now we've got mustard and radishes and like clovers, linseed, and it's full of pollinators. Like, it's a beautiful sight. Like, and that's, it's one of the things you're like, ah, I'm doing good for the environment, I'm doing good for the soil, and I'm doing good for pollinators. And it's like, it's one of those really like, because agriculture gets bashed so much right now, basically for like emissions and all this other stuff. And it's like, there are these techniques that we can do which can change what we do. And it's like, now for 6 months, those fields are giving back to nature. We're feeding the soil, we're feeding diversity, and we're feeding pollinators and all sorts of other things. And to me, that's like, it's about trying to get a really good, healthy soil to then have a really nice crop. And even in terms of some of the beers, like, we might end up with higher protein levels than some of our heritage grains if we have a really fertile soil. And it's like one of the challenges. But at the same time, if we go to do a Method Goose or something like that, some of those beers, you end up putting in 40% wheat to try and get some proteins in there and get these long aging things. So I'm like, well, some of these historical beers, I might get the protein from different sources in that context, basically. But that's what's interesting about being a farmer, a maltster, and a brewer. Because it's like, if I was just a farmer, I'd be like, ah, that's too much protein, they don't want it. It's like, yeah, they don't want it for lager. But what if you're doing something that you use lots of protein in? Or if you're brewing a beer that you want to do it really fresh, New England IPA, and it's like, you want to put loads of wheat in there, and loads of things. It's not meant for aging. Then do you worry about the protein? Is it, do you know? So like, that's like, in a way, we're like, a lot of the time I break a lot of rules, basically. Like, and even in terms of beer styles, I'm like, I made a beer and it's like, yeah, it's amber. We're going to call it amber ale or something. Do you know what I mean? But it's like, is that to the specific guidelines? Like, yeah, but like, it's, I think so. Like, whatever. That's, you know, because like, if I roasted the grains in a frying pan, I don't know what color, like, coat it is exactly or what, like, you know, like, so it's a very different, but it's just interesting. And even we're at a grain social there, because I'm all about trying to promote local grains and local, get all of this stuff going, because like, it's agroecology basically, and it's like, it's a different approach basically of like looking after the soil, looking after what you grow, but you also have to look after where that food goes to kind of be consumed locally. And so like, and the same thing in our wheat, like, we can grow bread wheat in Ireland, it just may not fit within the large industrialized system, but it would work lovely with sourdough, you know, and stone ground, lots of flavor, use fresh, you can get great bread, you know. And you need a skilled baker, because even if it's got a certain protein level, it may just behave differently because it's a heritage malt, and that protein is a simplified sort of measurement. Like, there's much more going on than basically just protein, you know. And so that's like, that's one of the things. And it's like, but historically we used to like grow grain, when there was a more agrarian society, we used to consume our grain much fresher, basically. So that's, I like grains.
Oh, no, same. We're always very interested in all of this. And again, even when you're just looking at the level of like, you know, how much is barley versus wheat or oats, or again, maybe like an ancient grain, you know, potentially, like, to what extent do you feel other people are kind of embracing this approach and either growing their own or trying to get back to this kind of more sustainable model? Like, we know there are a couple of other breweries who, at least in Ireland, who are trying to do more of it, but there's still only a handful of you guys. So how do you see the trend?
Well, because they're not all batshit crazy. That's because it is so difficult to do it this way. Like, as if that's, it's one of the guys is like, you're basically doing the hardest way possible. It's like,
you're doing all the things instead of some of the things.
One thing. And I think there's a lot more people doing it and trying it, and that's great. Do you know, like Hope making a beer with someone growing local grain. That's wonderful. Yeah. And the more interaction between farmers and processors and customers, that's better. It gets that connection back going. And yeah, like, because even in whiskey, as in water distillery, they're now looking at terroir and the flavor of different farms and different varieties. And they've done papers on it to kind of show the different flavor effect. And it's like, absolutely, it happens. You've got different climates. We know on the farm that, like, there's certain fields close to the Shannon, and I don't know what it is with soil, they will always ripen first. It doesn't matter if you sow them 2 weeks later, they will ripen first. It's just aspect, water, something. It just, they're different, you know? And it's like, it is one of the things people said to us initially, is like, well, how can you get consistency if you're so small? It's like, one, do I want to be consistent? You know, is an artist consistent? Maybe in style, not in like, not trying to produce the same painting every time, basically. But it's like but that individual field can be consistent as long as it's all the same soil type and harvested in the same day. Then you've got consistency in that exact thing. And it's like the big boys do it by blending grain from Donegal, Cork, and all the different varieties, blend it all together and do massive batches, and they get consistency. Like, you can never be consistent. It's like, one, I don't want to be consistent, but actually, if I want to be, I can be within that batch. And it's like, oh, what about 2023? It'll be different. It's like, yeah, so what? I'm going to put the year on. It's like, this is the year of the malt, because we do it in wine. It's like each, you buy the same wine as like 2015, 16. It's each wine is slightly different. They try and make the same grain or the same wine, but it will evolve based on the weather and the inputs and all these other things. So be it. Why hide it? You know, whereas brewers are always changing their recipes to try and keep the same consistent. And I'm like, no, I want to celebrate the connection between customers and field, you know. I want the customers to say, yeah, this is this year's version of that beer. It's a different beer, similar characteristics, similar barrels, similar culture, but it will evolve and change as our taste buds change.
Absolutely.
Do you know what I mean? So that's, and to me, that's much more interesting sort of story, journey, experience, you know. So let's not make everything bland. Let's bring some variety and interest into the life, you know? So the more breweries connect with farmers and say, cool, can we get to buy a field off you and use that field for, like, that's great. We should all be trying to do that and encourage to do that, because we have a great environment for malting barley. Like, that's, red wheat is more challenging, but like malting barley every day, it's good. Like, we can do that, you know? And something else that I was going to say, but I forgot.
Yeah, I know. I just be curious kind of what it would be like, because I feel like it's sort of, you know, Canvas, so you guys obviously, Ballyhill Cabin, 12 acres. Like, have you guys ever thought about coming together for a sort of, you know, Frankenstein's monster of a sort of own grown beer, or what would that be like?
Yeah, I'll bring the crazy yeast and infect the roars. Yeah, like, and that's like each of those, even if we grow the same varieties, there'd be slight differences between them. Now, again, okay, if we brewed it in three different brew houses, the brew houses will have these effects, you know, and like there's all of these effects that, like, the brewer does have the hand of the brewers in everything. Like, even though we brew a crazy amount of different styles, there's certain choices that I make that all, like, I try and make my beers drier, because I'm just like, that's sort of where I'm at. I'm like, I don't want lots of residual sugar, you know?
Yeah.
And that's, which actually ties me into Saison. That was what I was going to say, actually. Because we do brew with diastatic yeast, basically, which is a scary experience, basically. but we're also a Saison brewery, and in terms of time and stuff, because when we're farming, like, I was in the field and I was like, oh crap, I meant to be on a podcast. So I rush back, basically. But it's times of the years where we just don't brew, basically, because it's all hands on deck. It's harvest, you got to do it, you know. And today, with two dry days, we'll be sowing our winter oats tomorrow. You know, that's, there's a process, and we don't brew in those times. But come into winter time, come before Christmas, it's time to hibernate. And then it's like, okay, into the brewery, let's go create beers and do kind of all these different things. And then that's when you do the malting during winter, come into springtime, you know, and you have this evolution at different times. And that's, so even though we don't always brew Saison, we're actually, we're a farmhouse brewery. We're producing farmhouse beer, but we're actually a Saison brewery because we're brewing seasonally. And try and use the time, like use elderflower or use whatever ingredients are around basically at the time. So that this, when you're using the pine tips, you know, you want to brew that in springtime because that's when you got the fresh tips. That's how you get the best flavors out of them.
Yeah.
You know, and try not to overdo it basically. but you know, if you do that out of season, you're going to get harsher flavors and be too earthy and not the right balance basically. But that's based off me looking at the pine tips and be like, that's good. Yeah, it's time to go. Let's brew that. So that's kind of my goal, is to get these kind of cycle of beers that will evolve based off what's around. And basically it'll be out of season and connect people back to seasonality as well. That like things change. That's just the way it is. You know, things are in season, things are out of season. And let's look forward to when it's coming back in season again, because that means it's springtime or it's summertime again, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I was listening to a podcast with Martin Cornell the other day where he was saying, you know, it's nice to, you know, have that familiar thing you get from your local brewery, knowing that it changes over time, and to know that, oh, you know, maybe this is when it has these characteristics. Maybe this is the time of year it has those characteristics, but they're not going to be the same. It's still the same product, but it's going to evolve. And people used to be okay with that, and then they sort of got into all this commercial stuff and it was less okay with that. But I think it's such an interesting idea to sort of see the seasonality of it. So it's very much kind of like you're saying, there's sort of the art and the science, but then there's also just that experience of knowing what's happening out there in nature. And that's, I feel like so many people are kind of divorced from that just because you don't see it day to day if you live in the city or, you know, that kind of thing. So how do you kind of bring that to the fore for people to try to help them understand what's going on there?
Well, you see, I wreck people's heads really, because it's always changing. And, you know, they're like, oh, I had that one. Can I have that one again? I'm just like, no.
Like, nope.
No. And like, yeah, I do get the familiar as we brew. The longer I'm brewing, we'll probably have some familiar beers more, basically, to kind of have that element of familiarity more. Because like when we're brewing a real wide range, it's like, you know, I'm like, do you like a sour beer? Because like, that's a sour beer. That's very different to this other beer. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You could alienate people quite easily, basically, if they pick a sour beer and they don't know what they're about to drink, basically. Now, at the same time, what I'm trying to do is, a term I use is conscious consumption, that you need to read the label, as in when you know exactly what it is, you can like open that beer and drink it and you don't need to think about it. And that has its time and place, like, don't get me wrong, you know?
Yeah.
But there's also a time when you need, well, maybe it's my kind of personal thing to be like, okay, what do I want? You know, people are like, what's my favorite beer? And I'm like, I don't have a favorite.
Yeah, it depends on so many things.
Context, time, mood, the like weather. All these things.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? As to like what suits you right now. And okay, that makes it difficult. Kind of people is going to be like, oh, I'll bring some beer over from us. It's like, yeah, okay, I can see how I might be a bit difficult to be. Bring me a lambic beer. Always going to love that one, basically. But it's by making people think about their surroundings, where things are coming from. You know, if more breweries started connecting with their farmers, or like being like, I want to brew with grain from here, or like, can you grow this grain for me? And can you grow a cover crop before to make nice soil health? And can you do all these positive things? And the farmer, he's like, yeah, if you, this isn't going to mass market, I'll sell that to you. We can agree a price and have a consistent. And who cares about the price of grain in Paris or something? You know,
right.
I'm growing it and I'm selling it to you and you sell it to people. Yeah, let's have a nice solid grain. And then it takes the risk out of it. You've got a connection, you got community, you got all those wonderful things that like, that I'd love to see more of that basically around the place. And the more people will then be like, do you know what? There is terroir and grain. Like there's
absolutely.
I actually use the Irish word counter, because counter, it's your surroundings. And because all of that stuff influences what makes our grain taste basically and what our beer tastes. Now, in my sense, it there's also kind of probably a philosophical, because I'm trying to use the herbs and the ethos and all those other bits. But at the same time, terroir is just a French word, because they've been talking about it for ages, you know, and we accept it in wine. So we need to talk about counter in our grain, that it's about our surroundings, like where this grain comes from, and connect back into it.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, especially kind of like you say, like some of these have been grown for hundreds or maybe even in some cases thousands of years in broadly the same location. So it's interesting to be able to trace that back, whether it's, you know, one family or, you know, many, many different families coming and going. And it's there's just such an interesting story to be told there, even if we don't know all the details, that you can kind of trace out through this ingredient.
Oh, because that was very funny, because actually, sorry, in my family, the brewers back a couple of generations. Mm-hmm. And then it was like, I was like, ooh, can we find, and I found some ads for them looking, saying we've got quality varieties, you know, come buy seed. And you're like, oh, there's Archer. It's like, oh, I'm growing Sprout Archer. And this is, okay, let's see what this is. It's like, yeah, someone had some recipes somewhere, I'd be all over now.
Yeah, absolutely. All your local history libraries, you don't know what you might have there. So just, you know, make sure your finding aids are up to date. All good stuff. Absolutely. So we should start to wrap up in a minute. But Christina, any questions for me? I know I can see you've got like ideas, and I know you've got some side project stuff too that you've got notions about. But
oh yeah, I just have thoughts. Like just like in my own head, I'm just like taking it all in and just thinking. Yeah, just like thinking about like what I've come across like in my own research and just kind of putting two and two together. And like I came across a grain variety called Hastevel, which is an early ripening grain. In the account rolls of Christchurch, when it was a priory in the 1300s. So that was kind of really cool to come across. And then of course, was able to pull like some grain bills for a potential brew. I was just thinking, like just thinking about, you know, using what's local and that concept. And I think that makes a lot of sense. And like that's another question, you know, that I get a lot of, well, what kind of herbs would they use? Well, what season, you know, right. When are they brewing?
Where
are they brewing? And, you know, like this idea of seasonality is just really, really important. And I think that's just so great that that's what you're doing. I just really like that. Just really fascinating. Just taking it all in, absorbing it all.
Oh, like as in, and those heritage grains, like they do, like I managed to find a few more basically at the weekend. Ooh. And I was like, ooh, let's grow these. Yeah. I am trying to rationalize some of our growing, because like the more trial plots you get, the more like craziness, and there is a limit to my time I'm finding out. But like when you've like grains are so fascinating, because you're like, there's a new variety, and you're like, oh cool, let's see what this is, you know. And it's like there's discussions around Bear, which is that it's an early variety grown in Scotland. And it's like, I had this experience of there's a six row Irish variety, and it's there is a six row, it means it's six rows of grains basically, as opposed to two rows. And it ripened a bit early. And then I'm like, oh, that's similar characteristics to like, you know, and then you're like, oh, you're starting to connect these things together. And what's cool is it kind of brings to light stuff in history. Do you know what I mean? And it's like, you know, if you're trying to do a historical grain bill, you know, you got to think about the processes, but you got to think about the raw ingredients and how that was distributed and all those other things. And the more you do it, kind of the more interesting those things kind of come out. And it's like, so one of the things of heritage grains is that we used to cut them with a sickle. And it's like they're not necessarily suited to a combine harvester. You know, we used to cut them with a sickle, store them, use a straw for thatch, you know, trash them separately. So you have to imagine all the different things. And it's like, to me, the future will be a blend of that history and using some of the modern stuff that we figured out about, like, so we use seaweed basically on our molten barley too, because it's a biostimulant. I use it as a seed dressing to get better germination, all these cool biological things. And I'm like, but we can kind of tie all these different elements together and get to future. But like, yeah, I do love when someone is like, oh, there's a weird grain variety. I'm like, oh, interesting. Let's go read about this and see what. So like, I am trying to grow out all these other different things. Cause it's like, most of our beer is barley, right? But then we got wheat and oats, and now I'm trying to grow out a population rye. And then it's like, oh, what other grains can we get that would add interesting flavors or do interesting things in the system, do you know? Because back then, like, there's all sorts of fascinating, like, when you look at seed banks, there's all sorts of, like, weird grains, and there's, like, reference to them, and you're like, what is it? You know, you probably have to grow it to see, like, is this the red-looking grain? Like, which is the early ripening ones? You know, because, like, what someone's view is on centuries ago was saying, this is early ripening. What does that mean? You know what I mean? Compared to modern, like, what's going on? But what's cool is that when you go back to those ones, like, a lot of our barleys, okay, we've got modern varieties of barley, but they're actually all very narrow in terms of what's going on. Whereas once you step back to these, like, other varieties, then you're like, oh, this is completely different. Like, this is way different genetics. Flavors, you know, like, it's all different. Yeah. So that's what I'm like. Whenever someone comes up with a new one, or not comes up with a new one, they exist already, but someone tells me about a new one, or like, do you want to try this? And I'm like, I'm a sucker. I'm like, yep, I'll try that. Let's see if we can grow it and see what we can do with it and figure out what it could do, or what it could, you know, get an understanding of it, you know?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
And the other thing is actually of these heritage varieties is, and this is kind of one of the interesting things, it's like, if they live in a seed bank, like, then it's in a book, it's in an archive. It's like, but if we can get some of these heritage and these populations out and growing, now it's in living culture. Now it's sustained. And that's a way of actually preserving and having a window back into previous life, our ancestors and all of that. And it's easy sometimes, like, and we've an old cottage, and it's easy to be nostalgic or be like, oh, ancient times were these wonderful times. They had no stresses and no social media, and, like, it was just perfect. And, like, yeah, that's not quite true. Like, life is tough and things, you know, so, like, you have to use a little bit of, and that's some of these varieties, you do grow them and then they're terrible. And you're like, okay, yeah, right. That's not, yeah, that's not awesome. Maybe that one can stay in the history books, but that's my goal is to try and get some of these historical things, or kind of find out as much about what a farmhouse culture and some of these old cultures, and see what we can kind of bring back to life and bring into the vernacular, and bring that back into society, you know, bring it back into people being like, oh, you want to do something based on a farm, go, these guys have rekindled something, go come visit and I'll show you how it's done, and this is my take on what I think history was or what our culture was about, you know.
Which
is cool, like, and that's the other, like, we share a farm with a neighbor, and that's the old Irish word is mehel, and it's like, it's people talk about mehel and it's old, it's like, we can do it in modern life, and it's like, no money exchange hands, but we share, you know, we share the risks and we work for each other, and that's, you know, and it's a nice sharing relationship, and it makes farming more fun, you know, because we get jobs done together, and it does have a practical, like, use, like, it is technically more efficient, basically, but at the same time, it there's a social side of it, which is also equally as important, you know?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Even just the social side of, you know, deciding what you're going to grow. I know, like, my in-laws get the American Seed Savers catalog and they're going through it every year on a holiday. That's what they do in the winters, figure out what they're going to grow starting in whatever, February. And I love some of the almost sort of overly romanticized names some of the varieties have for different things. And then, but they've done the same thing. They'll plant some things and be like, no. And then others are like, oh, wow, this is amazing. And you wouldn't know because no one's grown it for decades or possibly even longer. And that's just thinking about, like, your sort of standard garden vegetables. So it's
and what's cool about it, it's like, you can then, a lot of those varieties, you can keep the seeds and then you can share them with a neighbor and be like, hey, cool, I got this really cool variety, you should grow it, it's really tasty or whatever. And then that brings variety, and we're not just growing all the same type of onion or all the same type of tomato. Do you know what I mean? It's like, oh, I got absolutely a cool one. let's swap seeds, and then you, and that's how you create culture, and that's how you create resilience, and it's fun and interesting, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. Does this grow better up on this cliff versus down, you know, near the river? All of those things, even if it's the same area, like, it could be very different. So
because our soil is different, like, we know it in certain fields.
Yeah,
the soil changes within that field, and that's, you know, there's just certain characteristics, and I probably will get to the stage where we'll end up Well, I probably will have more varieties than I need, basically. But it's like, yeah, okay, these could probably do well in some other part of the country. And then, you know, at least if mine fail, there's some somewhere else.
Yeah,
you know?
Absolutely. Well, as we begin to wrap up, are there any, first, where should people find your beer? But also, what's coming? What's your sort of, in the secret lab, what should we keep an eye out for? So both of those things.
Yet to be decided. we will be back in stock around Dublin, basically all good craft, not all good. Whoever responds to my emails saying, like, hey, right. You haven't heard me in a while, but do you want some beer? And some of them say, yeah, cool. And then I supply them beer. A few local places and then online you can reach us as well. What's coming up? Basically we brew different beers. There's a lot of beers in barrels. So I'm going to be going through the process of evaluating what's ready, what's not, and what will be ready to go out into the world, spread its wings and to be shared. There's always interesting things going that whether they see the light of day, that's the big question, basically.
Or do you want to keep them for yourselves too? I mean, you never know. It could be one of those things where, like, this is so good, it's all for me. So I know I had that happen on occasion, but only with very small batches. I mean, we're talking 3 gallons, not 3 liters, but
yeah. Still. Once you're in a 240 liter,
yeah, it's a different story.
Shouldn't be consuming all of that myself. I wouldn't. but yeah, no, we have a bunch of wild beers, a bunch of barrel aged things, and. Yeah, oh, there's a green malt beer, actually, which someone was asking me about, which that's a whole different kettle of fish, which actually I need to check up and see how it is.
Ooh,
basically,
interesting.
Malted the grain, killing it to dry it out, and then basically mashed it and brewed a beer out of it. So it's got all the flavors of malt, of cucumber, of greenness, this kind of green grass. I'm still unsure if that makes it awesome. Like, technically, it's awesome. But I'm like, in terms of flavors, I'm still on the fence on it, basically. So I'll have to check up on it again and see if at some stage I'm either going to have to dump it or it or do something. So that stage is coming soon. So either it'll be out and hopefully it'll be awesome. It may be interesting of that. So that may be a beer actually that I might can some of it and only available if you're talking to me and I'll give it as a special.
I mean, you hear so much about, you know, sort of fresh hop beers, but that's a very different, like you say, different kettle of fish entirely. But you know, you never know, maybe that'll start a trend in the same way that, you know, sort of happened in the Pacific Northwest.
It's technically really hard, actually. It won't start.
No trends.
Yeah. I mean, I'd like to think I could set trends, but this one I can see. Although, interestingly, Guinness brewed with green malt like in the 50s or 60s and they did an academic paper on it. Being like, technically just makes sense. And with the energy, the idea is the energy saving. Don't spend all that energy drying the grain. So I was like, let's give that a shot, basically.
So very relevant for our times,
but like you'd have to change so much stuff, like your whole malt house would, or your whole brew house would have to adapt. So maybe not.
False economy possibly, but interesting experiment. I think enough of our listeners are nerdy enough that they might be interested in trying that either way, so you know, just to see. Perfect. Well, thank you so much. So with that, I think we'll go ahead and wrap up. So I will say thank you again to everyone who's liking, subscribing. Again, we're at Beer Ladies Pod on all of the socials, and you can go to our link tree, find us there. But again, thank you to Christina as well for being my other co-host today and doing, like she said, a lot of nodding along, but it was very good nodding along. But with that, again, we'll say thank you so much. Keep an eye out for all that new stuff coming from Canvas, or for those little bits of good stuff coming from Canvas. It's out there. But I think absolutely it's such an important message to sort of think about what are these older things we can be using out in the world today? How do they potentially help the environment, and how are they maybe better on the sort of both sort of economically and just sort of for everyone else out there, think about seasonality. So with that, I'll say thank you very much and we'll see you next week. Bye.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.